Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
The surprising finding was that in the experiments, it turned out to be the most perfect fluid that was ever produced in experiments.
Austrian scientists are rethinking the early universe's state of matter. Turns out it may not have been a quark-gluon plasma after all. Hello, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Meanwhile, in Latvia, some schoolchildren are using a new kind of attendance monitoring system, but not everyone thinks it's a good idea.
It has to be something that people can choose, not that everybody is controlled and monitored all the time. It has to be something that you opt in.
Plus, German scientists have cracked the encryption on satellite phones. But first, a new technique for making cheaper anti-malarial drugs. All that and more this week on Spectrum. German scientists have developed a method to produce artemisinin, the most effective anti-malaria drug, cheaply and in large quantities. Their findings were published in the journal Angewandte Chemie International Edition in January. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
Artemisinin comes from a plant called Artemisia annua, but the yield from the plant is very low. In fact, the byproduct, artemisinic acid, outstrips the useful yield 10 to 1. But scientists at the Max Planck Institute and the Free University in Berlin have found a way to convert this byproduct that's currently thrown away into the useful drug molecule. Usually, pharmaceutical manufacturers use what's called a batch process, where in layman's terms, chemicals are mixed together in a large pot. Frank Seeberger, director of the Max Planck Institute of Colloids and Interfaces and professor of chemistry at the Free University in Berlin, uses a process called continuous flow chemistry. That's where the chemicals are passed continuously through a tube and the materials can react with one another. And that makes the process more efficient. It's a process that's been used in manufacturing and oil refining, but it's relatively new in the lab environment. Seeberger takes me to the lab to show me the setup.
We have a starting material that's in a flask. Tubes go into the flask via a pump. The material is pushed through relatively thin tubing where light can shine through. And there's now the key piece of our reaction process. It's a reactor that consists of a very strong lamp. That lamp is also generating heat. That's why it's surrounded by a quartz glass cooling device. And around that cooling device, there is about 8 meters of a approximately 0.5 millimeter thin tubing. And that tubing assures that the entire solution is completely irradiated at all times.
Seeberger hopes that flow chemistry could streamline the production of artemisinin for use in combination therapies against malaria.
And then you continually operate, then it takes approximately 400 to 500 of these very small reactors we built to make those 150 tons per year. So although it's a formidable amount of material, you can actually use very small instruments to make it.
That 150 tons is around 65 tons more than the amount of artemisinin produced currently using conventional means. The original reactor cost around 50,000 euros, but Seeberger and his team say they've been able to simplify the process and the cost could come down significantly. Seeberger is looking to work with companies like Amyris or Sanofi, who are isolating artemisinin from plants and who have plenty of waste product that they could convert. Frank Mockenhaupt, head of the malaria research group at the Institute for Tropical Medicine at the Charité Hospital in Berlin, says that Seeberger's findings are important, but there are also other factors to consider.
It might reduce the cost to a very large extent, and that should enable to produce higher numbers of the truck, lowering the cost. That is good. But starting from here, we still need to have the distribution channels, we need to have the trucks on stock, we need to consider the shelf lives and a lot of logistical issues.
These logistical issues include poor distribution channels, health systems, and governmental problems in poor countries that prevent anti-malarial drugs actually getting to the people who need them. And of course, everyone is concerned about drug resistance, which is starting to be seen in some parts of the world, most notably the Thai-Cambodian border. For the past 12 years, Seeberger has also been working on a malaria vaccine and ultimately hopes that that will be the way forward.
Vaccines are the least expensive way for societies to protect itself against infectious disease. We see this in all the developed countries, as we have seen against polio and smallpox, for example.
But of course, many researchers and public health officials caution against putting all their eggs in one basket, that is, to pin all their hopes on simply vaccinating everyone. Again, Frank Mockenhaupt of the Charité Hospital in Berlin.
Even if there would be a vaccine, we still would need the drugs, because the vaccines that we can anticipate today have an efficacy of 50%. So still 50% would need treatment. Thus, we cannot just concentrate, focus on vaccines.
Both Seeberger and Mockenhaupt agree that malaria needs to be fought on many different fronts with many different methods. Over the past 10 years, public health experts have shown that the most effective way to control malaria in East and West Africa is to use insecticide-treated bed nets.
We see up to 50% reductions in cases of malaria, but also in fatal cases. And most likely, much of this is due to the efficient distribution of insecticide-treated bed nets and also of the now available good and working ACT treatments.
Seeberger says that the first commercial prototypes of the reactors to produce artemisinin will be ready to go in the third quarter of 2012 and hopes they'll be deployed early in 2013. Cinnamon Nippard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Now, here's a question. Is there a limit on how fluid a fluid can actually be? Physicists have predicted that a liquid's viscosity, or its ability to flow, has a lower limit. They've also predicted that only fluids like quark-gluon plasma, which existed in the first flash at the birth of the universe, approach this limit. Plasma, of course, is a state of matter related to a gas when some of its particles are ionized. But it turns out that quark-gluon plasma may actually be a liquid, and in fact a perfect liquid, one with a much lower viscosity than had previously been believed. And the Austrian team says this finding may help us take a step closer to better understanding our early universe. Kerry Skyring reports from Vienna.
Okay, well, let's see if we can find some soup.
If you take just a regular menu, the soup is included. It looks like a high viscosity fluid.
So I was thinking about frittatum soup.
I think today it's just pea cream soup.
So it's going to be high viscosity.
It's high viscosity, it's colorful, so that's perhaps appropriate for quark soup.
I'm in a queue with Professor Anton Reban and doctoral student Dominik Steineder in the cafeteria of Vienna's Technical University. I'm trying to conceal my ignorance of physics, but I now know that pea soup has greater viscosity than a beef broth. In other words, it's thicker and denser. According to a new paper published in Physical Review Letters just last month, quark soup, the quark-gluon plasma, is the thinnest soup of all, and that provides another small window into better understanding our early universe. This soup is a special state of matter that only exists at an extremely high temperature and/or density. That only has happened, as far as we know, when the universe was very, very young.
This system of freely roaming quarks that originally filled the entire universe is called the quark-gluon plasma. And it has been thought to have the properties of a plasma rather than a fluid. And the surprising finding was that in the experiments, it turned out to be the most perfect fluid that was ever produced in experiments.
What are the properties of a perfect fluid?
Well, the perfect fluid has no internal friction. Locally, at least, a perfect fluid has pressure the same in all directions, so it quickly removes anything that brings structure into the fluid.
When Dominik Steineder set out to calculate the viscosity of quark soup, the other name for quark-gluon plasma, he used string theory. That's an experimental physics theory that has been used to predict quark soup's very low viscosity in the first place. But Steineder took a different approach. He presumed the fluid lacked consistency or pressure in all directions. To use the technical term, this fluid is anisotropic as opposed to isotropic. The result was a surprise. It predicts the viscosity of that primal fluid, the quark soup, as being below earlier calculations.
Yes, so the difference, what was considered before, were only isotropic systems. So it was the same no matter in what direction you look. And when you just repeat the calculation which you did for these isotropic systems, in this anisotropic system, you find that the viscosity in this direction really seems to get smaller and smaller as the system gets more and more anisotropic, which was a surprising finding.
It's difficult to get a grip on what this means without imagining the Big Bang. In the first milliseconds after that event, the entire universe consisted of quark soup. Whether it was very thin or very, very thin soup would dramatically affect how the fluid spread, says Dr. Urs Wiedemann. He heads the group of theoretical physicists working on quark-gluon plasma at CERN in Switzerland. He's examined the work done by the Vienna team.
And their calculation is the first calculation that points to the fact that the dissipative property, so this attenuation of waves in a fluid, would then be very different in different directions. So this qualitative insight of the work of Repan and Steineder has a very good chance to be constrained by experimental data, I think.
In other words, Wiedemann thinks that this work is solid and promising, and he would know, given that scientists at CERN are working on recreating such a quark soup by smashing lead ions into each other. And Professor Johanna Erdmenger, a physicist at the Heisenberg Institute in Munich, thinks this new insight into the fluid properties of the material will help understand how the universe was formed.
Well, I think that's a very exciting new result. Well, first of all, this very low number, which was known previously, was already a very new and exciting result. And so now that they found an even lower value is even more exciting.
Back in Vienna, Anton Reban is trying not to get too excited about the result. In fact, there is always a question mark over theoretical modelling. But he likes to point out the success of his fellow physicists in using string theory to predict the existence of quark soup in the first place. For the 26-year-old Steineder, who still has to complete his doctorate, it's a big motivation knowing there's somewhere like CERN's Large Hadron Collider to test his contribution to our understanding of the universe.
So then my biggest wish would be that something like this lower viscosity has some experimental imprint in what they find at the CERN, but even if it's not so, it will be interesting what they find and whether our work has any relation to this or not. But this is really the whole motivation for me to do this stuff.
And on the strength of his stuff, Steineder has been offered a position with a leading research institute in Paris. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
Coming up, a German security researcher breaks the encryption on satellite phones. But first, here's Holly Fox with the news.
A team of British scientists has come up with a mathematical formula that describes the shape of a ponytail. The new formula takes into account the stiffness of hairs, the effects of gravity, and the presence of random curliness in a person's hair. As anyone with long hair knows, the ponytail swells outward when bundled, but until now there had been no set of equations to describe this motion. The group says that this research may have applications in computer graphics, video games, and animation, because realistic representations of hair are difficult to code. The research was published last week in the journal Physical Review Letters. A British developer has created a new online data visualization app showing what many women have long suspected, that there are vast discrepancies between fashion label sizing. Last week, Anna Powell-Smith released the What Size Am I online app. It allows women to input their measurements, and then the site will return the best fitting sizes from various clothing retailers, including Banana Republic and French Connection. She found that the difference between the same size can vary by as much as 4 inches. And finally today, the United States has announced it will scale back its space cooperation with Europe as part of a new budget bill. The new Obama administration budget announced last week stops a deal between NASA and the European Space Agency to cooperate on Mars robotic rover missions in 2016 and 2018. According to the Agence France-Presse, NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said that tough choices had to be made in axing the European deal. However, he remained committed to rebuilding the Mars program so that future robotics missions could potentially be revisited in 2018 to 2020. The Mars exploration plan is facing a 40% cut in the new budgetary proposal.
Holly Fox with the news there. You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Cyrus Farivar. And now, it's time for Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Now, when it comes to safety at schools, universities, or other institutions, there are various technologies where you have to use a key card in order to enter the building. But 1 month ago, two Latvian companies, an internet startup and an e-ticketing operator, presented a combined safety feature that includes a public transport key card with an access card. In order to get into a school, pupils have to swipe their e-ticket in front of turnstiles installed at the building's entrance. All of this has come as a result of some security concerns at Latvian schools. But with the legacy of Soviet surveillance looming, not everyone is thrilled about this new attendance monitoring system. From Riga, Gerrits Gelzis reports.
Public transport in Riga is no longer the only place where pupils have to touch a reader with a card while they ride to school. Since October, the first 12th grade kids from three secondary schools in the capital have to use a blue plastic ID card to get inside. The case has each student's photo and name printed on one side and the word etalons or e-ticket on the other as a pass when entering their school. Back in autumn, one Latvian and two Russian language schools were equipped with turnstiles in a bid to increase safety in schools. It's an experiment initiated by two companies, and one of them is Rīgas Karte, a firm which established the e-ticketing system in the city 4 years ago. Erik Morizur is the managing director of Rīgas Karte.
When the student waves the card in front of the turnstile, we identify the card number. It's a unique number. And we send it to the server of the school. And in this server, they can identify who is going in the school or who is going out of the school. There is a link between the serial number of the card and the school students within the school only.
There's special software in the turnstiles which reads the e-ticket's number, and if the mechanical gate recognizes it, then the pupil can get through. Outsiders are not able to enter these three schools. Rīgas Karte manages the turnstiles, the integrated software side. But another app receives that data. MyCub is a web-based school management system designed by a Latvian internet startup back in 2009. Though there are an increasing number of edtech tools to help students learn better, few exist that look at whether or not they are actually in school. Gits Ljaudoks is one of the developers of the software.
When you enter school and you don't swipe the card, that means that the teacher will see you absent at the lesson, so you are not interested to get in the school without scanning. It's in your personal convenience, and that way the parents can see the information as well and school can get the analytics.
As soon as a student goes through the turnstile, the information about the attendance appears in the online class register along with the lesson timetable, tests and other features. And if parents log on the site, they can view the information about their kid for free unless they want to receive special notifications on the phone. The 49th secondary school in Riga is one of the three schools testing the new safety system, and all the kids that I spoke with said they don't object to being checked on by MyCub every day. But not everybody is happy with the software.
Currently there are quite a lot of bugs in that system, and sometimes MyCub isn't showing rightly who is present and who is not.
That's Pauls Anš, an 18-year-old student in 12th grade. He said that sometimes the system shows he wasn't in class when he actually was. He can't edit the information about attendance himself. That said, he doesn't feel like being oppressed or tracked by the technology, as there have always been strict rules for the discipline in the school. For instance, it's been a long-standing tradition for Latvian students to have to clean a classroom or a corridor if he or she comes late. Some academics are also critical of the idea of tracking children through their e-tickets. They say that there's no acute problem with safety at schools, and it's a step towards a complete surveillance society. And Latvia is no stranger to a surveillance society. It spent about half of the 20th century under Soviet occupation. Klaus Sedlaniks is a social anthropologist at Riga Stradiņš University.
It shouldn't be a default measure. It has to be something that people can choose, not that everybody is controlled and monitored all the time. It has to be something that you opt in. If a kid has some kind of problems or something, then you make these measures and say, well, until you behave as an adult, we are not controlling you.
Meanwhile, MyCub and Rīgas Karte are already planning to widen the functions of the e-ticket and use it as pupils' ID card and payment card at the school's canteen too. In fact, the payment card is already undergoing a trial at a tiny school with just 200 kids at Aluksne, a city of just 9,000 people in northern Latvia near the Estonian border. Here's Erik Morizur again.
There is a device which we have installed, a reader. It's exactly like in a bus. So the child is presenting the card within 2-3 centimeters from the device, and on the screen the operator will see, okay, this is the kind of meal for this person.
First, though, Morizur and his colleagues at MyGuba are interested in whether the e-ticket will prove itself as an effective entrance card at schools. At present, there are around 500 out of nearly 900 primary and secondary schools that have voluntarily registered at the MyGuba site. But for now, only 3 of them have so far implemented the e-ticket-controlled entry system. Jadars Dielzis, Deutsche Welle Radio, Riga.
If you like, you can download Digital Europe as a separate podcast. Just search for DW Digital Europe in iTunes. Speaking of security, let's talk a little bit about encryption. Hundreds of thousands of people worldwide rely on satellite phones for communication in remote, war-torn, or disaster areas. Although expensive, many customers are willing to pay a pretty penny to have reliable communication in areas that don't have conventional mobile phone service. Usually that means government contractors or employees who are sent out to far-flung corners of the globe. Like modern mobile phones, satellite phones are equipped with built-in encryption that makes it theoretically difficult for anyone monitoring radio signals across the airwaves to know what is being said. However, German researchers at Ruhr University Bochum in western Germany said earlier this month that they've now managed to crack 2 of the commonly used encryption protocols, known as A5-GMR1 and A5-GMR2. The first one is related to an existing cipher called A5-2, which was introduced in 1999, but it was quickly cracked by another team of security researchers. Since July 2006, the GSM Association said it would no longer support A5-2 and would go back to an earlier version, A5-1, which was believed to have been stronger. But A5-1 itself was cracked in 2009. These satellite phone encryption protocols are commonly used in the Thuraya satellite phones used in Africa, Eurasia, and the Middle East. The Bochum team has published their results in a new paper called Don't Trust Satellite Phones. To learn more, I spoke with Benedikt Driessen, one of the paper's authors. Now, I understand that you have written this new report with your colleague Ralf Hund, entitled Don't Trust Satellite Phones. So why shouldn't we trust satellite phones?
What we discovered is that the encryption mechanisms in these phones are basically very weak, and we can assume that this is probably known since, I don't know, the beginning of the century, because at that point, similar algorithms were discovered for GSM, and they were soon discovered to be weak. And well, and since they are quite similar, people in the satellite phone community will probably know that they employed similar algorithms for satellite phones, and they should be aware that this is weak too.
Why do you think that this has been known for over a decade now?
Well, the attacks on GSM are one decade old, and since for one of the systems we have analyzed, the same attack applies. This is probably what the community or the people behind the NDAs will know also. So, but this is just an assumption. We don't know about that, and we don't know specifically that they know it, but we assume that they will know it.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the attack vector, the way that you attack a GSM encryption, is a similar way that you attack the encryption that's used on satellite phones.
Basically, yes. There's a distinction because we have attacked 2 standards, and for one standard, what you just said is true. For the other standard, there's a different encryption mechanism which does not have any resemblance to what is used for GSM. So it's only partially correct.
So these 2 encryption standards, at least as far as they're used on satellite phones, are called GMR1 and GMR2. Can you walk me through the process of how you go about trying to crack something like this?
Okay, just another clarification. The satellite phone standards, which define modulation issues and other stuff, they are called GMR1 and GMR2. The encryption mechanisms or algorithms in these standards, they are called A5-GMR1 and A5-GMR2. And well, if you want to go decrypt something for GMR1, you have to set up an antenna somewhere. You have to find the right time slot when the victim you want to decrypt actually uses his phone. Then you have to capture the data with the antenna, and then you have to execute the attack on the data, and then you get the encryption key. What we did right now is that we have a demonstration system where I recorded one call for myself, and the surroundings, and everything was well controlled because I knew when the call is happening and everything. But if you were going to develop some real sophisticated interception tool, you would need probably some more, because you would need to know how to target someone specifically and stuff like that. But we didn't care about that right now. So I know you should probably have a method to identify a person you want to intercept the calls of, and well, then you have to have this antenna in the area, and then you have to just record and wait for the person to do a call, and then you have to do the decryption, and the decryption just requires you to have some encrypted data for GMR1, which you put on a PC, and then you have some software which is running there, and it's just running for some minutes, and then you get the encryption key, and with that you can decrypt the data. However, what must be said is that we are currently only concerned with decrypting data. So because we basically use open source software, which is kind of in its infancy right now, they don't support actually replaying decrypted data. So we can decrypt the data, and we are quite sure that we have decrypted correctly, but we cannot replay the speech we have decrypted. So we cannot make it audible in the sense that, you know, I can intercept your data and then I can just hear what you said.
Wait, so in other words, you can't, it takes some time. It's not a real-time decryption.
Well, our demonstration system isn't real time at the moment, but the attack is very easy to parallelize. If you just have, I don't know, happen to have €100,000, you can probably do it in real time.
What's next for you in this type of research?
Well, right now we don't have any specific ideas. Maybe we can just go ahead and do what I said before. We are quite limited right now in our demonstration system. We can improve on that, but I think the main point we wanted to prove is proven, and that is the security is basically weak. We could also look at other systems, but right now we just have to figure out what all this means and how the companies will react, and after that we will look what we will do in the future.
All right, Benedikt Driessen, I appreciate your time, and best of luck in your future research.
Thank you.
Benedikt Driessen is a researcher at Ruhr University, Bochum. That's all for this week on Spectrum. Want to learn more about something you heard on the show? Send us a message on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. In between episodes, you can always find daily news updates at dw.de/science. You can always email us your questions and comments to feedback.english@dw.de. Also, please be sure to put Spectrum in the subject line. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Cyrus Farivar, and thanks for listening.
Tell me, can you hear the crack from a hard life breaking? Can you see the flood from the waves of my regret? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? No more cards to play. In a corner, I surrender to your way. To your way. I don't wanna live my life for less than nothing. I don't wanna gain the world if I lose my soul. Change you could.